Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, most South Africans lack critical illness cover as financial risks surge. Inside South Africa's booming pet economy and the rise of extreme pet pampering. Rate cuts offer relief for households, but the recovery is still fragile. And why the mock crisis trend is weakening brand credibility. It's Friday, the 28th of November. Now, it would seem that South Africans are carrying a dangerous blind spot. More than 85%, I read, have no critical illness cover. And those who do, on average, only a quarter of the protection they have actually needed. Greg, again, I missed out a word there and I want to get this right. South Africans, it seems, are carrying a dangerous blind spot. More than 85% have no critical illness cover, and those who do have, on average, only a quarter of the protection they need. It's a financial time bomb. It's fueled by psychology, optimism, bias, denial, and the belief that good health or youth somehow offers immunity. But when cancer or heart disease or stroke hits, families face not only an emotional shock, but also a catastrophic financial collapse. It's an important issue, and I'm going to talk about it with Greg Smith, founder, joint chief executive officer of Dis-Chem Life. Greg, a very warm welcome to you. And maybe let's start off with a philosophical question. Why do you think South Africans cling so strongly to the belief that serious illness is not going to happen to us, despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary?
Hi, Jeremy. Well, thank you very much for having me. I think it's a fantastic question. I think it is something that South Africans, especially insurers, we try to figure out. But I think it comes from a deep psychological blind spot that us as humans have, which delay the taking out. And where, without getting too technical, I mean, it is not a logical reason why, I guess, South Africans and I guess generally humans don't take it out. It's more a behavioral one, in the sense that people generally are way too optimistic. You know, they intellectually know that cancer, strokes, heart attacks are very common occurrences. And yet for themselves on an emotional level, they say, well, it's not going to happen to me. And they also feel, it's called the normalcy bias is that people feel if I've been healthy, you know, in the past, I'm going to continue to be healthy. Things will just continue as they are. And lastly, and probably most importantly, is we live in a world where there's an illusion of control. And it's saying that, well, if I continue to be healthy in the future and I continue to eat well and exercise, catastrophic events will never happen to me. But unfortunately, the reality is that it's, you know, maybe genetic, hereditary, God forbid, or, you know, you're in a car accident, things like that happen. So people take the view that this creates, you know, it creates a blind spot for them where they delay the onset and taking out for a while.
So I absolutely understand the pressures, and I'm interested in that normalcy bias that you talk about. But how do you practically then, Greg, break through those psychological barriers in a country that is just overwhelmed by the difficulty of daily survival?
It's so relevant in the South African context. I think the one is education. I think, you know, in the South African context, people believe that if they have medical aid or, you know, they go to a state facility, then they're covered. But what we have to understand is that medical aid and state hospitals, facilities, they cover the ongoing treatment of things like cancers, heart attacks, and, you know, well, that front and ongoing. But things that, you know, once you survive the events, the ongoing additional costs such as going to rehabilitation, having nurses, changing your home, lifestyle events, getting new age benefits and cancer treatments that may not exist on a medical aid, that's where that knowledge comes in. So one, through education, and two, it's making products that are accessible. So creating products that people can actually see so they understand it, and that's kind of what we're doing in our world of Dis-Chem Life. We're trying to put advisors in stores so people can engage and learn about it. So accessibility and actually designing products and fundamentally that meet the need. So traditionally, insurance and critical illness was just for when you had it and was a lump sum payment. But you need to move into a time where it becomes ongoing and you pay on a consistent basis, to cover, cancer goes in remission and comes back. People spend over R1 million on cancer treatments a year and in certain circumstances. So when you design with that in mind, and that's what we're looking to do, you actually create a benefit that actually suits the consumer mindset.
So let me pick you up, Greg, on the second point that you make. And I'd suggest to you, and please defend it, that the industry itself is partly to blame for this crisis. That insurance is too complex and obviously too expensive, or simply just badly communicated to the average consumer.
I fully agree. It's a complete legacy issue. And complexity was the third thing I was going to say. Why people don't take it out is a combination of education. They think they're covered. Behavioral biases, I don't need it today, I'm healthy, until it becomes so immediate in their face, and complexity. So you have to design simple products that you can communicate easily, that people understand the value. So I fully agree. I think it's been a legacy issue. We're working very hard to change that. And there's different ways that you can design. So simplicity is core to our structures. But yes, traditionally people add on, different things and bells and whistles and stuff like that, which make it very, very hard in the consumer's mind to differentiate.
Greg, I think the figure that would frighten most people is that 85% have no cover in this respect. At what point, or are we there already, does this move from being a personal financial issue to a national public health and economic risk?
You've hit the nail on the head. So I think the even more frightening stat is that when ACESA did an actual analysis of this, right, of actually the shortfall, we have a 50.4 trillion rand gap year. And I'll repeat that, 50.4 trillion rand. That's a lot of zeros. And the problem with that, and yes, there's a number, it's big, but the second order effect that we have a national problem with it is that it affects, so if individuals and households don't prepare for this, and they have a very critical illness, and they either lean on the employer, the public health care, or the social support structures, which overburden those structures and leave, I guess the individuals in a bad situation, and so does leave society. And then what happens is for the individuals is if they don't have the money, what they start doing, unfortunately, is taking on debt, selling assets under value, and going through financial strain, which puts the entire family at risk. So there is a massive, massive risk that us as a society and individuals as households also currently have, unfortunately.
So a final question then, how do you convince lower and middle income earners that this is not optional, that it's absolutely critical, particularly in this environment where things like food, transport and school fees inevitably come first?
I think you do two things. I think what the first thing you do is you have to have it at a price point, a simple product at a price point which that LSM can digest. And the second thing is you have to create a product that's attractive. So what I believe and what we try to do is create something that gives you tangible value right now. Insurance is sold, not bought, in every fundamental sense. But if you create something, I say, Jeremy, we're going to sell insurance to you. And, people in different LSM classes then say, take it out. But through our rewards program, you can get up to 100% off in-store at every Dis-Chem nationwide. It changes the dynamic because it's not one-to-one. We're not just taking food off the table. We're providing immediate value in-store and trying to get people healthier. So you balance that through immediate rewards in a present value world where people want tangibility now to offset that kind of expense strain, I would say.
I'm going to leave it there. Greg Smith, founder, joint chief executive officer of Dis-Chem Life. It's an important issue, and thank you for throwing some light on it. I do appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's pet economy is exploding, with more than 20 million pets nationwide and a market worth an estimated 8 to 10 billion rand a year. Spending on so-called fur babies has become one of the country's most resilient consumer trends. And futurist Dion Chang captures the shift in his excellent new book. It's called Porphict, The Life of Fur Babies. It explores how pets have moved from companions to fully fledged family members. And interestingly, how that transformation is reshaping retail, lifestyle, and the broader economy. Dion, a very warm welcome to you. The pet economy in South Africa worth billions, as I've just said. From where you sit, what's driving the surge in spending on our pets?
There's quite a lot of different threads that are coming together. So, I mean, I think one of them is it started off looking at declining birth rates and aging populations around the world. And I started noticing that on both sides of the planet, in America as well as in Asia, China and Japan, you are getting this phenomenon where there are more households with pets than children under the age of 15. So when I started digging deeper into that, you start layering on things like the child-free movement. So there's a lot of women or young couples saying they don't really, really want to have kids. They'd rather have a fur baby and not bring somebody into what looks like a hot mess of the world. So all of that's been growing steadily over the years. And you can start seeing the trajectory even in emerging markets. So South Africa is following the same trajectory around the world. You look at the acquisitions of the different big supermarkets with their own pet offerings or buying up companies that deal with pet care. And I started digging into the luxury aspect of it as well. So almost every single big name luxury brand has a pet collection in it. There are hotels that offer room service menu for dogs. Michelin star chefs do that. You've got private jet airlines that do that. There's a whole category of interior design called barkitecture, is when you accommodate your fur child into your home and you build them little nooks and crannies and decorate with them. So it's really, really exploding. And interestingly enough, if you look at the top five countries that are ranked as the most pet friendly, South Africa actually sits at number 4. So we're not far behind with this pet economy.
Yeah, I like that turn of phrase, barkitecture. And I know someone who spent a fortune on something that you refer to in the book as a catio, which I think is fairly self-explanatory. Dion, I'm wondering if this growth is mainly confined to higher income households in South Africa or a trend spreading right across all demographics.
I think it started with higher demographics and your more affluent customer. But in the book, I also interview an animal behaviorist, and she says just the clients she's got in South Africa, a lot of your young Gen Zs who don't want or can't see them affording a family in the future are having fur babies. And she says that even they say, I'm not having kids. This is my child. I'm going to spend whatever it takes, either on healthcare or otherwise travel or just to accommodate their every wish. So I think it's trickling down. It started off on the high end, and I think that's where the biggest growth is. Like I said, almost every single luxury brand has already got their offering, and you're starting to see that trickle down into all kind of demographics.
Which I guess begs the question, this trend, whether it be premium food, treats, grooming, whatever the case is, are you discerning that it's a long-term lifestyle change, or maybe it fades as the economy slows?
No, I think it's a long-term one, specifically because of the trends we were tracking with demographics, and also the shift in what people consider a nuclear family. So a lot of those social contracts have been changing over the past couple of years. You are seeing just more and more declining birth rates around the world. And then if you layer on younger generations that say they're not going to have kids, they'd rather do the fur babies, this for me is a very, very long-term trend, and it's a big shift. You're also starting to see, very interestingly, legislation around the world change the concept of family law to include pets as sentient beings, not just as property where pets were usually listed in there. So even in legislation around the world, you're starting to see that change.
There really has become a fight among the big retailers, ShopRite, Woolworths, Spar, all playing in that space. But I'm wondering whether local or smaller entrepreneurs, Dion, benefit from the trend, or is this just engulfed by the majors?
Look, I think the majors, and it's that's really significant. You see, you know, you saw the acquisitions last year between, and every single supermarket brand is fighting for that position. Where I think there's space is for a lot of services. So that's just in its nascent phase in South Africa. So there are global platforms called, say, Rover.com. They link pet owners with dog sitters or pet sitters and walkers, daycare centers, all of those kind of things. So those smaller businesses have a lot of room to flourish. Whereas I think your big retailers are going to take care of the food and a lot of the accessories. But I think in terms of the services, there's a lot of niche areas where that growth is going to definitely boom.
And to what extent has social media shaped the way in which we relate to and spend on our pets?
Absolutely. I mean, you're seeing already when I talk about, you know, the sort of younger generations not wanting to have kids, there are plenty of those reels on Instagram where they say, this is how my generation drops their grandkids off for the weekend with the grandparents, and they open the door and there's either a cat or a dog sitting in a pram with that. So that kind of mindset is being echoed and being enhanced across the world and across all social media platforms, whether it's TikTok or Instagram. And specifically, it was a rich source for the book, you know, to actually see how to make a meowtini. So that's a martini for your cat. And the gourmet meals that people cook for the animals. It's very entertaining. The book is meant to make you shake your head at the absurdity of it all. But I think if you are that dedicated pet parent, you would secretly wish you had the means to indulge your fur baby like that.
And the book is called A Perfect Life, The Ultimate Guide to Pet Parenting. The author is Dion Chang. The publisher is Pan Macmillan. Dion, thank you very much indeed. Appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
New data out from the Altron FinTech Household Resilience Index shows that while falling interest rates are offering some breathing room, the financial resilience of South African households still remains painfully fragile. The index is up 2.3% year on year, but over the broader rate hiking cycle, the gains are barely above zero. And without the extraordinary surge in early pension withdrawals under the two-pot system, the picture, one thinks, would have looked even weaker. I'm in conversation now with Dr. Rudolf Buerter, who is the economist behind this study. Rudolf, when you strip out the two-pot pension withdrawals, how weak is the true underlying picture then of household resilience?
Not so good. My colleagues at the Optimum Group have also watched this impact very closely. I'm their economic advisor. By the way, they've just been awarded the Discretionary Fund Manager of the Year award by the Citywire. I just had to slip that in. Jeremy, I'm very proud of the guys there. But without the two-pot system artificial increase, as Jan Gelatly, the MD of Altron FinTech, calls it, as you've indicated, it's barely above zero since the rate hiking cycle started. If you compare that to the average real increase in the GDP since the end of 2021 to the second quarter of this year, that was 1.2%. So households are suffering. It's as easy as that.
So there's no genuine broad-based recovery in household finances, as you're suggesting, and that is likely to continue? Or do you think that this might ease slightly as we get into 2026?
The operative word here is slightly, Jeremy, because I was aghast when I was so hoping that it would not happen. But this 3% inflation point was one of the worst things that could happen to our economy right now. In fact, the current composition of the MPC, as far as I'm concerned, but at least Mr. Godongwana managed to incorporate that, what they call band of tolerance, up to 4%. So effectively what has happened now is that South Africa's inflation target range from 3 to 6%, that's what it used to be, is now 3 to 4%. So we've lost that 200 basis point sort of comfort zone. And what worries me and disturbs me terribly is that when the rand exchange rate starts to weaken, it has to happen at some point in time. It is unnaturally strong due to the weakness of the dollar, but that will change probably in the course of next year. If that happens, then your producer price index, by virtue of the fact that we import just about all of our oil and petrol and diesel and such a lot of intermediary components that go into our manufacturing sector, our producer price index will increase. consumption price index, there's a lagged effect, will also increase. And the minute inflation goes above 4%, and that's going to happen next year at some point in time, I'm sure, then they're going to raise interest rates again. It was a disastrous decision for the South African economy and for the prospect of job creation, because the MPC have lost sight of the urgent need to create jobs for 15 million South Africans that cannot find a job.
And if this trajectory then pans out, as you're suggesting, in real terms, what does that mean for consumers and resilience?
Well, if you're lucky enough to have a formal sector job, you're bound to get, you know, somewhere between 3 and 5% salary increase. Interest rates may still come down by 25 bips. You see, that's the other dilemma. Our other dilemma is that the scope for lower interest rates as a result of this new inflation target has now been eroded. I cannot see for the life of me with the current MPC that the prime rate, via the repo, of course, will ever drop to below 10% again. The point that one needs to remember here is that with the previous Monetary Policy Committee, when Jill Marcus was in charge and the governor of the Reserve Bank, during her five-year tenure, the average real prime rate, prime minus CPI, was 3.4%. Today, after this latest interest rate reduction, it is exactly 100% higher, 6.8, exactly 100% higher. So the cost of capital and of credit has doubled. How can you grow an economy with a 47% unemployment rate if you have the highest real interest rate in the world of any emerging market or any advanced economy? It doesn't make any sense, not economically.
If, as you're suggesting, household consumption remains constrained now and into the future, where do you think then meaningful GDP growth is going to come from, if at all?
Well, they will probably, when I say they, the MPC will probably get some benefit from growth that will be derived out of our mining sector. And maybe, but it's not going to happen overnight, with a little bit more beneficiation and value added before we just ship the stuff out. That's going to help us a lot, especially the platinum group metals. I mean, that price increase has been between 60 and 70%. That's fantastic news for National Treasury as well, which should place them in a position with greater private sector participation, also with the assistance of the Democratic, the DA involvement in the government of national unity. If they can nail the construction mafia, which Mr. McPherson is trying to do, and put the new Minister of Provincial Affairs, he's from the IFP's plan, in action to start fixing our municipalities, we could get to maybe very close to 2% growth next year, despite the high interest rates, and if the rand doesn't weaken tremendously. But the problem is that we have a structural problem with regard to a lack of demand. The capacity utilization in South Africa's manufacturing sector is still below the level that it was in the beginning of 2019. And the reason for that is a lack of demand. I don't know whether the MPC ignores these data sets. It seems like that.
Just finally, in one other data set, and I want to circle back to the two-pot system. If I read the report correctly, delivering something like 12, 13 billion rand in unexpected tax, that was a real windfall, a sign of distress rather than prudent financial planning. But it also says that we're seeing households using retirement savings these days as a short-term survival tool, and that, Roelof, is not sustainable.
You're 100% correct. On the one hand, one has empathy for a person with a low-paid formal sector job. His car breaks down, his or her, and they dip into the savings, you know, to get over that financial constraint. They're going to have to work harder or longer or smarter or a combination of the three. But certainly, it's a short-term solution, and it's not good for any, you know, for the South African economy in the longer term.
And those are the details, the top line details from the Altron FinTech Household Resilience Index. I've been in conversation with economist Dr. Roelof Botha. Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, I notice a strange trend is taking hold in marketing. Brands using mock crisis apologies for, and I put this in inverted commas, being too good at what they do. Now, it looks clever. I've seen it play out in a couple of instances. But there is a suggestion that it plays dangerously with the language and structure of real crisis communication. Raheen de la Rue is managing director of the agency Reputation Matters, and she argues that brands should stop apologizing for success and maybe just start getting back to basics, if I read this correctly, and just start communicating with a degree of confidence and clarity. Raheen, a very warm welcome to you. So this fake crisis trend, what do you think is fueling it?
I honestly just think it's a trend that companies are jumping on the bandwagon on, to be quite honest. When I saw the first one, I thought, okay, clever, but it just didn't sit well with me. And then more and more companies were doing it. And I just thought, oh my goodness, what do we have ourselves into here? It's just like finding a clickbait type of marketing campaign, putting people into like a high crisis situation, and it's like, oh no, we're actually sorry, we're just joking, sorry that we're so good, sorry that you're having fun, and just apologizing for being good, which I think from a reputation management point of view, why on earth would you want to put yourself on the back foot? So I just don't get it.
Let's talk about reputation management and the consequence in just a moment. But these are not small brands that are doing it either, are they?
No, and it's everybody's jumping on it. And I think there's a place and time for trends. And I am absolutely for witty and innovative and being clever. But I think when it treads the line of something like a crisis, which is quite serious, when there's a crisis, you know, a very disciplined thing that you need to do for an organization, because when there's a crisis, am I at risk? Is my family safe? Are my kids safe? What needs to be done? Now you're seeing these things, and it's as if companies are crying wolf, because when there is a serious thing where we need to get the attention of our audience, people are going to think, it's just another joke. We're not going to worry about it.
And that's exactly the problem, is that any kind of crisis communication, I think you suggest, carries real emotional weight. And how does turning something like that into a joke then affect public trust, if, in fact, the brand has to at some point, which it will, have to deal with a genuine crisis?
Absolutely. It just totally undermines the credibility of the organization that puts it out there. It just unsettles that whole foundation. People want authentic communication. I mean, there is so much communication out there as it is, and having to wade through all of that stuff. And you know what? It just cheapens the whole thing of that hard earned credibility that organizations are building up for themselves. I just sometimes wonder how these things get approved around the boardroom table, to be quite honest.
Is it jumping on a trend, do you think, or is it maybe that brands these days, in this clutter of noise and communication, have either forgotten how to, or simply unclear or unsure of how to articulate success authentically?
I think so. It boggles the mind that people aren't sharing authentic stories of their success. Why, as I mentioned earlier, put yourself on the back foot of it? And it is just trying to be quirky with just hitting the false note in terms of trying to share your story in a very credible way.
I'm glad you used the word quirky, because often in brand communication that is effective. It works well. And brands should be able to balance humor and creativity with a degree, I would imagine, of seriousness. Not always easy to do, though.
Absolutely. Exactly. And, it is so important to be clever and creative, but it's making sure that we use the tools in the right way for the right audience, strengthening your reputation through all the different communication channels. So instead of pretending to apologize, brands can celebrate it just a lot more honestly and using it more effectively, because I just am so mindful, as I said earlier, you put out all these mock crisis things, although I must admit I'm seeing fewer of them. I've always said, PR hasn't always PR'd itself particularly well, but it is working incredibly hard to get that space, to get that voice, to build reputations, to build credible organizations. And it's as if the marketing teams have jumped onto that credibility that the PR PR groups have worked on from a crisis communication and kind of making fun of it. And I think there's so much hard work behind the scenes for a crisis, which just kind of just poo-poos the whole thing of all that hard work.
So often brands want to replicate what they perceive to be the success of other brands. So often in my coverage of the advertising industry, I've spoken to brands who've gone to their agencies and said, well, make me a Nando's ad. And it doesn't work that way. So if you were giving advice to a company tempted to try this trend, what do you think the single biggest question they should ask themselves is before pressing publish?
What do you want to achieve with such a campaign? We actually, years ago, Jeremy, had a client who wanted us to run a campaign for them. They needed some serious reputation repair work. And they wanted me to help them. Okay, first of all, they asked me to take me off Google, which obviously we know they can't be done. And then they wanted SEO, search engine optimization. If you entered their company name with a name with Crook, they wanted their names to come up. And the more I was trying to explain to them, you know what, you're trying to be too clever. You're treading such a fine line here. What is it that you want to achieve? Why do you want to be associated with Crook? Why do you want to be associated with a crisis? What do you want to achieve with this campaign? So I think that's one of the key questions to ask. What is it that we want our customers to do? If you're going to send out a crisis notice, do you want your customers to unnecessarily have that millisecond of stress that you're causing them about the safety of anything that they're involved with? So I would definitely highly recommend, if a client comes to me wanting to do that, I would highly recommend them to reconsider just not to go down that route.
All right, let's close the loop on the conversation then. Once the brand has answered that question, what would your recommendation be for the strongest and simplest alternative to a staged apology?
I think it is going back just a couple of steps and understanding the audience and understanding your organization, your values that you stand for, and understanding that audience and making sure that I don't want to come across like a whole party pooper for not wanting to follow these trends.
Yeah.
But I think there's so many more creative ways to come up with. Let's maybe just go back to the drawing board. Let's come up with something more innovative. Why copy a trend? Let's come up with something more fun, something different that can set us apart with all of this noise, that isn't going to irritate everybody, that isn't going to come across as clickbait, and that isn't just going, and we're not going to lose our audience with our messaging.
Some good advice there for companies who want to embark on what can obviously be a very treacherous, dangerous, and even a silly journey. Rahin LaRue, thank you very much indeed. Managing Director of the agency Reputation Matters. Some good insights there. I appreciate your time. And that is our program for today and for the week. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.